noticing how much calming or how much the cultivation of serenity or tranquility, the calming of the formations is very much the forerunner to sama samadhi, wise concentration. Now, I have to confess here that concentration is not quite a very good translation of samadhi. It's a little bit too limited, because samadhi, certainly in Buddhist teaching, refers to all forms of meditation practice is sama samadhi. You know, so the cultivation of the Brahmaviharas, for example, of loving kindness, of compassion, of joy and equanimity would fall under the umbrella of sama samadhi. Insight practices would fall under that umbrella. So would deep states of concentration practices, because you can see whenever you have a practice of meditation, there is built into it the intention to collect and gather the attentiveness, to focus, to cultivate one-pointedness, and to be able to sustain an object of meditation. So all of that falls under sama samadhi. So wise concentration can be seen in several different ways then. One is the cultivation of any particular style of formal meditation practice. The other is the sama samadhi that is brought into our life, the cultivation of an undistracted mind that is attending wholeheartedly to whatever is predominant in the moment. And probably the dimension of sama samadhi, which is, I have to say, given considerable weight in the Buddhist path, is the cultivation of wise concentration, particularly through the deep absorption states or jhana states. Now, I would want to acknowledge that the cultivation of deep concentration states was probably the predominant style of meditation that the Buddha first trained in. It was the predominant style in India at that time was to achieved altered states of consciousness, essentially, through concentration practice. So it was pretty much a pre-Bodhi tree style of practice. It's also noticeable that in post-Bodhi tree, that this is a style of practice that the Buddha continued to emphasize and to give tremendous value to. Probably acknowledging how difficult insight is without a mind that is really unified and undistracted. Now, I find certainly, you know, wise concentration, or probably better to say, the lack of wise concentration, is the Achilles heel of most people's practice. The ability to sustain attention, to sustain one-pointedness, is the Achilles heel of most people's practice. You know, the mind that is distracted. I mean, the Buddha just compared the unconcentrated mind to a fish taken out of water, flapping about on dry land. You know, similarly, I think in our lives, we can see how the unconcentrated mind is simply flitting from thought to thought, from idea to idea, from impulse to impulse, without any kind of steadiness. Certainly my experience in teaching at this point in my life is, see, I don't think new students do deep concentration practices very easily, because I think it takes a lot of insight to undertake deep states of concentration and that practice. You know, and again, it's coming back to that sense of indebtedness. You know, if we're there's so many things in our life we are not at peace with, that we're arguing with, a lot of unfinished business, quite frankly, to try and undertake concentration practices in the midst of that is nigh near impossible. There's too much that is calling for our attention, too much that is dragging our attention away from the object, you know. And then the attempt to cultivate concentration often becomes this big struggle, striving effort that often ends up in frustration. But I do find that this time in my own life, I find that many of the people who are coming to undertake more sustained concentration training are more experienced students, older students, you know, who are recognizing that this is a kind of a missing piece in their practice or an Achilles heel in their practice. And so on a foundation of insight and not being in such a state of contention, you know, with everything that's going on, able to kind of develop deeper states of concentration with more ease. One of the reasons why I think concentration is so important is that there can exist a considerable gap between insight and embodiment. And I think it's very important to question why that is. You know, why we find it at times so difficult to embody what we really understand to be true and what we value and what we love. Why we seem to be kind of shooting ourselves in the foot over and over again, or sort of acting against our wisest and best intentions. And I think one thing that can explain that a little bit is that I think when insight happens, and insights do come to us for sure, but when insights come and they're simply appearing in a landscape which is equally featuring lots of papancha and proliferation and, you know, craving and aversion, I think we have the experience sometimes that insights don't seem to sink down onto a cellular level. We know it, but we're not living in the light of it. And, you know, that is, I think, an extraordinarily frustrating experience. You know, and that's when we kind of have actually more spiritual residues, I think, when we say, you know, I really didn't need to go there, you know, I really actually know a better, a wiser way to act and to speak and to think. So I think sometimes that frustration, you know, or the lack of concentration, I think, you know, because when insights arise in a mind where there's a great deal of stillness and calmness, I think there's a way that those insights permeate almost into our bone marrow. You know, they become really part of our psyche. They become part of our being. So personally, you know, I'm a big advocate of developing jhanas or doing deep concentration practice. You know, I'm a big supporter of cultivating absorption states. I think they're extraordinarily helpful. I think they change the shape of the mind in a lasting way. I'm not one of these people who think that concentration states, you know, are their neat experiences and then they pass and there's no lasting effect. I think the training in deep concentration actually alters the shape of our mind. The mind loses its infatuation with papancha, it becomes quite disinterested. You know, it's kind of like, why would I do that? You know, it's like being offered the choice between a gourmet meal and a bucket of nails. Most of us wouldn't choose the bucket of nails to eat, you know, because there's a knowing of such a deep inner stillness that is lovely, that is profoundly lovely. I think the mind loses its inclination to worry and to fret through deep training and concentration. I think it's a training for our life, you know, being able to focus, being able to think creatively, being able to think, just being able to think well. You know, somehow that is released within a mind of stillness or enabled by a mind of stillness. And sometimes that's such so much more difficult in a chaotic mind. I think one of the other lasting benefits of deep concentration is that there is a discovery of such profound inner joy and happiness that is so inwardly generated that there is actually really, I think, an abiding conviction that there is nothing that we are going to gain through craving, no element of pleasure or happiness that is actually going to compare with that inwardly generated profound happiness and joy. And quite frankly, as an insight, that really changes our relationship to the world. You know, it changes our inclination to follow pathways of craving. It changes our inclination to cling. I think in deep states of concentration, there is the encounter with such ease and spaciousness that, you know how when the mind is not so well trained, you know, when you're practicing and every once in a while you bump into a moment of calmness and you think, isn't that amazing? You know, and isn't that lovely? And it feels kind of like this lucky accident or this blessing. Well, you know what? In a well-trained mind, you know, you bump into a state of agitation and you think, isn't that odd? Isn't that unusual? You know, like, what is that all about? And what is that telling me? So there's a complete reversal of what is the norm. And that is actually quite a blessing, and not just a sort of transient experience and not just a sort of transient moment. There's something about the shape of the mind being changed when it is so well trained in undistractedness and one-pointedness.
A definition of jhana
states? Absorption states. Absorption states. There's eight of them. So the characteristics of wise concentration, and as we spoke about, there is such a thing as unwise concentration, you know, when it's not informed by many of the other, you know, awakening factors, when it's not informed by ethics, there is such a thing as unwise concentration. But wise concentration has this kind of unifying element. You know, it unifies body, mind, and present moment. It has an element of undistractedness. It has an element of wholesomeness in the sense of knowing what to give attention to and what not to give attention to. But again, in the seven factors, I just want to point out that wise concentration does not specifically allude to jhanas, but alludes to the capacity to cultivate a mind that knows how to sustain attention and sustain an object in attention. Now, wise concentration, too, no matter how we develop it in any style of meditation, it is also that, you know, the subtext is that it's a training in letting go. It's a training in renunciation. I mean, I'm sure you've all experienced this in the practice, you know, when you have an object of meditation, an object of attention, whether it's mindfulness of breathing or a metaphrase or mindfulness of body, the intention is there to sustain that object. So whenever you become entangled, whenever you become lost, whenever you become distracted, it's like that little memory kicks in, you know? Return. Come back. You know? Just come back. And every time you're doing that, of course, you are coming back from somewhere. And you are coming back from something. So that coming back in itself is, you know, again, making the parallel between our practice and our life, It is a training in renunciation. It's a training in disentangling. It's a training in unsticking. And that training is, in reality, meant to transfer off the cushion into the rest of our lives. It is also, so in that, it's equally, a training in renunciation is a training in non-clinging. Now, for most of us, the journey of wise concentration, which is often said to be a journey from applied to sustained attention. So applied attention is when you have the intention, you bring an object forward into the forefront of your mind, you have the intention to pay attention, you forget, you come back, you forget, you come back, you forget, you come back. That's applied attention. It takes some effort, it takes training, but what you do experience is that the more that you cultivate that, the more that that applied attention begins to turn into sustained attention. Where the object is resting in the forefront of your attention, it's more effortless. The attention really is liking to stay there. It's not prone to wandering. It's not prone to distractedness. Now, for most of us, the journey from applied attention to sustained attention is a journey through the hindrance factors. Amen? Just being aware. It's a journey through the hindrance factors. It's a journey through sloth and torpor and restlessness and worry and doubt and craving and aversion. So it is a journey through the hindrance factors. So it is said, and there's some debate in Buddhist circles about this. Some will say that what the training in wise concentration is a temporary suppression of the hindrance factors. I'm much more part of this other school that says the training in that journey from applied to sustained attention is a journey of beginning to uproot the hindrance factors. Beginning to uproot the hindrance factors. Bearing in mind that uprooting the hindrance factors is a journey in uprooting greed, hatred, and delusion. So it's kind of like the... It's sort of like the art and the craft of meditation. Like the craft of meditation is really all about the technique. And the art of meditation is really all about the awakening factors. About how we bring those awakening factors into the craft. How we cultivate the energy and the wise effort and the investigation and the joy. That's really the art piece of meditation. Now, the craft piece, this is not hard to learn. You just go buy a book, It's really not hard to learn the techniques. Most of the techniques are practiced. But the art piece, the kind of cultivation piece, this is where, a technique becomes a path, and in a way, it becomes our path. It becomes a sense of really kind of integrating and naturalizing a kind of attitudinal sense and sense of direction. And it's really, the craft piece, quite frankly, has real limits. The art piece, because I don't think there's a technique in the world that liberates. But the art piece, that is what liberates. The cultivations, the kind of bringing to fruition some of these qualities, that's the liberating piece, not the technique. I mean, it's so helpful, I think, constantly to remember, especially in this world, where you see competitive techniquing, my technique's the hotline to enlightenment, and my technique's better than your technique or this technique versus... It's so important to remember the Buddha never taught any techniques. The two primary meditative suttas in the Buddhist tradition are the Satipatthana Sutta, the base of insight meditation, and the Anapanasati Sutta, the base of developing wise concentration. These are the two discourses that have the most kind of specific areas of instruction. But isn't it all about contemplation, investigation, cultivation? Hard to find a technique in there. The techniques are skillful means, but one has to hold them fairly lightly. They're skillful means and they create a sort of roadmap, but they are a roadmap and not an end in themselves. And the Buddha was not prescriptive in that way at all. You know? And I sometimes see a sort of anxiety of meditators, you know, that if I just got the right technique, everything would be cool, you know. And if I just got the right technique, you know, I'd really, you know, get there, you know, express train to liberation. It's not that way. It's not that, or even a sort of partisan view of techniques. It's not that way in the discourses. But wise concentration, you know, and for example, like in the Anapanasati Sutta, where the Buddha talks a lot about developing wise concentration, you know, he talks about then developing it and turning that towards insight. But we should never, you know, you only need, if any of you have any passing acquaintanceship at all with Buddhist texts, you're not going to get away from the fact about how much the Buddha valued deep states of concentration. You know, and how much the Buddha valued jhanas. In fact, on, you know, in the story of his awakening, he says, I go into first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana, turn that towards insight, and hey, bingo, you know, it all falls into place. So it's just, I think, giving some, you know, it's moving away from mushy mindfulness. You know, it's a sort of mushy sense of just be aware or just be mindful. It's really speaking about a very refined capacity to penetrate between the surface of things, to change the shape of the mind, and to alter the shape of the mind, and most of all, I think, to experience the potentiality of our hearts and minds. You know, because certainly in deep states of concentration, some of these altered states of consciousness, it's pretty startling, the degree of rapture, the degree of joy, the depth of peace, the depth of equanimity that our hearts and minds can experience and access. You know, and then there is not, you know, that sense of it expanding our vision of the potentiality of our minds and hearts. It's really inspired by that. You may have anything about wise Sama Samadhi. Yeah.
In my own practice, I'm not seeing a progression of more concentration. I think. I mean, it's hard to quantify it, but I just feel like the is just as much there as it was 2.5 years ago or whenever I started.
And
I feel sometimes frustrated about that. That it's not, you know, I would like a little bit of calmness, even occasionally would be nice.
Good, yeah.
But it ain't happening.
Well, you know, I think there's a kind of healthy frustration. You know, I really actually think that's part of maybe discernment. You know, I mean, frustration can be very aversive. You know, it can be a very sort of kind of immature dissatisfaction. But I think there's something as a mature dissatisfaction.
You know?
When we kind of step back and look at the landscape of our practice and acknowledge, just as you've just acknowledged, this spin maybe doesn't seem to be decreasing. Probably there's other things that are increasing. You know, I mean, and I think not to be too narrow in that, because, you know, I think you have to have a sort of bigger sense of discernment than that. Is your capacity for patience, for kindness, for generosity increasing? You know, is your capacity for discernment about what is wholesome and unwholesome increasing? You know, so don't use that as the only barometer of progress in your path, okay? So I think it's very, very important to know that, you know, because, you know, that standing back in discernment actually means looking at the whole of our lives. You know, maybe there's little shifts here and there, You know, maybe I don't snap at my partner quite so readily, or, you know, heedlessly. You know, maybe I'm more mindful that that's not helpful. You know, all of those pieces are part of that discernment. So don't just single out one piece. But I think there is a mature dissatisfaction when you do step back and actually say, there is this one piece that seems to be kind of plateaued in a way. Then I don't think that, you know, it's kind of like how, you know, in the range of how we practice, I think sometimes there's a great value in taking periods of time that we dedicate to wise samadhi, you know? And that might, say, be like for a month. You know, that's the singular intention that you bring to your practice. Now, the difference between concentration practice and insight practice primarily lies in intention. So in cultivating wise concentration, there is only one intention, which is to let go of everything except your chosen focus. So it doesn't matter what else is arising, doesn't matter how interesting it is, you know, you let go of everything except your chosen focus. So say you've chosen as your focus mindfulness of breathing. You actually set that intention, and no matter what else is happening around it, you acknowledge the times when you've drifted, but just acknowledge. No investigation, you know, no interest, just knowing, and you come back to the breath. You make it so, so simple. You cultivate that off the cushion too, you know, when you're driving your car. Maybe I drive my car and not drive my car and listen to the radio, you know. Maybe when I'm listening to another person, I'm really coming into that with the intention to be wholeheartedly listening. So you're bringing forward that intentionality of one-pointedness into as much as possible in your life and in your cushion. Now, the intention in insight practice has the one-pointedness, but the additional intention of investigation, you know. So when your attention, for example, might be drawn away from your breathing to a thought or a body sensation, there's some curiosity and some investigation of that. There's not that sense of just put it down, come back. There's that sense of really know this, then perhaps come back. So that's the difference in intentionality. And, you know, I think, you can use Brahmavihara or metta practice in exactly the same way, you know. But you begin to naturalize one-pointedness on and off the cushion. And personally, I would see, you never have to worry in doing concentration practice that you're somehow going to miss out on insight. You know, because my experience with people who do concentration practices is that insights still arise. They tend not to arise so much on the cushion, and particularly as concentration develops and the mind stops, there's no insight on the cushion. But off the cushion, plenty. Off the cushion, plenty. So there's nothing to be lost, and perhaps something interesting to explore, say, for example, in taking a month where you just work with that singular intention of one-pointedness. You know? It takes some resolve. It takes a little bit more effort, you know, because it really is an application of effort to come back. But, you know, experiment for a month. See what effect it has on some of the spinning. There's nothing to be lost by it, and potentially something to be gained. And, you know, if you find that useful, then, you know, you incorporate that into the landscape of your practice. You know, perhaps you spend a couple of months of the year, you know, or perhaps you begin every sitting with a period, you know, where it's just that applied and sustained intention. You know, and then open up from there. I mean, there's ways to experiment with this. You know, that it's not just one way. There's ways to experiment with this. But initially, I would encourage you to give just a chunk of time where you explore this with it. It's just a sense of, let's see what happens. You know, as I say, there is nothing to be lost, and most of us can benefit in our lives from a deeper degree of one-pointedness. It really helps everything. And, you know, one-pointedness makes all other styles of meditation much more accessible and, you know, much less story in it. So I would go for it.
I was wondering, one of the things I have heard is that concentration, you can deepen concentration, you know, either by the returning to the same object as the, you know, normal concentration practice, or through sustained attention to changing objects,
yeah,
which is what you have in when you do Vipassana.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
Both are aspects of Samasamadhi. Both are aspects of Samasamadhi. I mean, if you look at all insight practices, they will include an aspect of Samasamadhi, of, you know, really paying wholehearted attention. It is one of the very, very important aspects of all meditation practice. You know? Concentration practice is just another dimension of Samasamadhi, which is actually much more about cultivating deeper states of absorption. So they're just different aspects of Samasamadhi. And, you know, I personally, I don't make a hierarchy out of them, you know. You know, it's just that personally I find that, you know, development of a deeper level, a deeper capacity to sustain attention is very helpful in most people's practice. But it's also not for everybody, you know. There's something a little bit temperamental about this, you know. Well, personally, I think they come together, I think, you know, because stability, I think, is that sense of undistractedness. You know, the mind is not moving away. There's a stability in the attention and in the object. I think clear comprehension and clarity has to be part of that, you know, because part of one-pointedness is the highlighting and the illuminating of the object. You know, so I think they pretty much go hand in hand. I don't think it's do one and then the other afterwards. I think they're kind of co-joined myself.
A little bit of reading I was doing on it was the stability, you know, work on that, and then the clarity.
I don't quite know. You know, I do think they go together because, you know, say if I was doing mindfulness of breathing as a concentration practice, you know, first I have to really illuminate the breath. You know, I have to really know the landscape of the breath, its beginning, its ending, you know, the life cycle of a single breath, because that would be necessary for me to sustain and stabilize the attention. You know, so in my sense is that I think they're kind of co-joined. You know, I mean, I would take them through the foundations of mindfulness, you know, which begins with mindfulness of breathing, you know, beginning to get a taste of that, beginning to get some sense of that, beginning to learn the benefits of it, most important, you know, and that's where the Satipatthana Sutta begins, you know, and then to expand that to the body, to mindfulness of the body, you know, in all the postures. I would actually go through the foundations of mindfulness. You know, I never underestimate people. You know, I try not to underestimate people. And personally, I think brand new students, as much as very, very old students, you know, kind of follow the same roadmap. You know, it's not like there's sort of special practices reserved for old students. You know. I think that we pretty much follow the same roadmap, You know, and certainly if you think about the time of the Buddha, you know, I mean, that was true in his time. You know, he never had like old student classes and new student classes, you know. Basically had these classes, you know, his second discourse was on emptiness. You know, so it kind of like wasn't, you know, first discourse was on the Four Noble Truths, second discourse was on emptiness. You know, so clearly, you know, I think there's a modeling there of kind of not underestimating people's capacity to understand when it is rooted in their life, the actuality of their life experience. You know, I think there's something about not confusing people with too much information at once, you know. So there's a certain simplicity which is certainly helpful. But I think the roadmap, say, of the Satipatthana Sutta is a very clear roadmap. You know, and very accessible for new students. Okay, so let's just whip through equanimity. Upekkha. Sometimes translated as unshakable poise. But I think it's very important to acknowledge that in Buddhist teaching, upekkha and nibbana are used interchangeably. So in many ways, upekkha, in the way that the Buddha used it, it's a synonym for liberation, and it is a fruition of all of these other qualities of awakening. So upekkha is not described just as a sort of state of mind, again, or a state of relationship. Upekkha is really speaking about the full or ultimate cooling of greed, hatred, and delusion. Spoken about really as blowing out the fires of greed, hatred, and delusion. But as in all qualities within Buddhist teaching, there is both path and fruition. So there is a cultivation of upekkha or equanimity, and the fruition of upekkha or equanimity is the same as nibbana. It's the same as liberation. So clearly the near enemy of equanimity is aloofness or indifference or remoteness. So it's very important to understand when the Buddha is talking about equanimity, he's not speaking about this kind of disengagement. He's not speaking about a state, he's speaking about a way of being in the midst of all things. Sometimes upekkha is described as a way of being when we are no longer conditioned or swayed by the tendencies or habits of greed, hatred, or delusion. When the mind, the heart, is no longer conditioned or swayed by those tendencies. So I think it is very important to understand the profundity that is kind of indicated in equanimity, which is really the uprooting of ignorance and a life in which the sense of self is no longer governing, and a life in which changing conditions is no longer governing consciousness. Upekkha or equanimity is describing an end of intoxication. An end of what we spoke about earlier, that intoxication with, you know, craving and aversion, but also this intoxication with this projected promise that into the world of things and people that this has the power to govern my happiness or unhappiness. There's no gatekeeper anymore. There's no gatekeeper of the heart anymore. the sense of not being imprisoned anywhere. But let's look at it as, look at first of all, as the path, you know? And because equanimity is a training, you know? Where do we get knocked off balance in this world? You know, where do we feel the lack of equanimity? Where do we feel ourselves kind of moving between the extremes of, you know, elation and despair, of happiness and unhappiness? And certainly, you know, the Buddha pointed, you know, to some of these life experiences that we all encounter. Where do we sense this? Where do we feel the sense of self and other most predominant in our lives? And I think for many of us, it is in the face of pain and pleasure. It's often where we see the sense of self most strongly arising, in pain and pleasure. I think it's in the face of gain and loss. You know, I'm such a, you know, I'm doing so wonderfully, I'm such a schmuck, you know, I'm such a success, I'm such a failure. I think we see the sense of self and the sense of imbalance arising most strongly in the face of approval and disapproval. That's, you know, pretty big one. It is a sense of how we practice being equally near all things. I mean, we don't have to practice equanimity in situations of neutrality much less. But we certainly have to practice equanimity or cultivate equanimity in the places where there's no equanimity. Because you can see, you know, the immediate sort of reactive element, can't you, and pleasure to move towards and pain to move away from, you know, and gain to move towards elation, you know, in loss to move towards despair. You see the rock, the waver. You know, the waver, the surrender of poise, the surrender of balance. So we don't practice equanimity outside of the difficult, but within the difficult. But we also have to practice equanimity in the face of the delightful and the pleasant. I mean, people often think about equanimity, this is something I practice in relationship to the painful. But quite frankly, we need to practice equanimity in relationship to the pleasant. Sorry, just as much. Just as much. So it's really... It's also easy to be equanimous about people and things we don't care about. Sometimes we really feel the lack of equanimity in relationship to things and people we fear, but I think the place often where equanimity is lost is in the places and people we most care about. Because that we so much have much, so much more empathy, so much more sense of connectedness, feel touched so much more deeply by the pain, for example, of people that we care about. I'd like to share with you some of the phrases of equanimity that I recently came across from a Sri Lankan translation, which I think very much is, it's really about this area of this dimension of our lives, of those we care about, those that we would like to rescue, those that we would like to save, those that we really have the empathy with. And those phrases go like this. It says, life is but a play of joy and sorrow. May I remain unshaken by life's rise and falls. I care for you deeply, but you are the parent of your actions and their consequences, and sadly I cannot protect you from distress. And I think there's something in those phrases which is very important for us. Life is but a play of joy and sorrow. May I remain unshaken by life's rise and fall. I care for you deeply, but you are the parent of your actions and their consequences, and sadly I cannot protect you from distress. And I think there is something very important in that for us, because it is totally human to want to rescue and to save and to heal those that we care about and the places where we often feel most helpless when we cannot rescue another from distress. I think equanimity is not then about not caring, it's about caring deeply, but acknowledging that we actually don't walk in the moccasins of another, and you know that actually someone might offer those same phrases to us. You know, that they care, another person might care for us deeply, but somewhere we're recognizing that our choices, our intentions, our actions and their consequences are truly arising from our hearts and our understanding or confusion. And in reality, as much as another can help us, in a sense, we are the only ones who can be upright in that and actually cultivate what is healing and liberating, or let go of what is unwholesome. So as much as we might feel ourselves offering those phrases to another as being upright in the face of another's suffering, there's somewhere in there about acknowledging how much we are also the parent of our own path and its consequences, and that no one can actually do that for us, just as we cannot really do it for another. It doesn't stop compassion, it doesn't stop empathy, but maybe it allows that uprightness and that equanimity to really begin to grow and develop. So in some ways, this is kind of, you know, the path of equanimity in relationship to those we love, the path of equanimity in relationship to those we struggle with and those we have difficulty with. We might not have that phrase in there, I care for you deeply. But we know that another is a parent of their actions and consequences in a way we do not have the power to alter that course. We can help, we can offer, we can be upright, we can be unafraid, but actually they're also going to bear their own consequences and not us. This is actually the root of compassion practice. You know, it is the root of compassion practice. It's the root of kindness practice that allows us to also extend compassion and kindness even to those who perpetrate suffering. You know, that they are the parent of their actions and their consequences, and we are not walking in those moccasins. So there is something about training in uprightness. Training and uprightness in terms of those world extremes that we all will experience, gain and loss and pleasure and pain and, you know, praise and blame. We can see how much equanimity is a wisdom practice in terms of taking the self out of those experiences. To know them as a mandala of conditions that none of us are going to avoid in this life. But learning to be steadfast and learning to be upright is actually perhaps the biggest of all wisdom practices. But this aspect of equanimity, which is really related, I think, to compassion and connectedness. And bear in mind that we are as connected to the people we hate as to the ones we love. So equanimity is important in both dimensions. But there's something about nurturing this practice of poise, nurturing this practice of unshakability. You know, it's like Reb Anderson once said, you know, that Buddhas don't turn the wheel of the Dharma in the suburbs of suffering they live downtown. You know, and there's something about cultivating, I think, this quality of equanimity, which is really a training in freedom. It's the training in liberation and the training of not being governed by the world of conditions that we cannot control, that we simply cannot control. But that does not mean we are helpless. Because what we are contributing to that world of conditions is, of course, everything that we cultivate and everything that we are committed to that allows us, perhaps, to be upright and to really train our hearts and minds in freedom, in not being governed. And I would come back to the Satipatthana Sutta, you know, that one of the phrases that is repeated over and over again is, learning to abide independent, not clinging to anything. Learning to abide independent, not clinging to anything. And it is, you know, the Buddha is presenting this as a training, as the intention behind our practice. Learning to abide independent, not clinging to anything. And not clinging to anything actually is another way of saying not being governed by anything. Which is certainly not to imply a lack of responsiveness, a lack of connectedness. But it is to imply that the reclaiming of the freedom of our hearts is not just some magical Bodhi tree experience, but that it is actually a training and a path that does have a fruition. Anybody have any questions about this last, or reflections about this last piece on equanimity? Yeah.
Just a point of clarification that it seems like because these trainings or these not states, but
qualities
appear in different lists, that they have slightly different.
Here it's actually in many places in the suttas you see it interchangeable with nibbana. It's just another one of the words that is used to describe nibbana. You know, like there's nibbana, there's nirodha, there's also upekkha. But in other places it's very much described as a Brahmavihara. But you have to remember, you know, for example, like in the Brahmaviharas, where it's easily conceived that equanimity is talking about conditioned states, the Buddha spoke about the Brahmaviharas as being complete paths of liberation in themselves. Okay? So in speaking about the Brahmaviharas as being complete paths of liberation, he's also speaking about the cultivation of a way of being and a fruition of that, including in the Brahmaviharas. The Brahmaviharas in the texts are not talked about as being some sort of secondary path, you know, or nice things to cultivate. They are actually spoken about as being paths of liberation, as doorways to nibbana as much as any other path. So not really as a conditioned state.
Earlier when you were saying about how we don't control the letting go, we cultivate to allow that to happen. And it seems in my life that this really understanding that others are the parent of their own actions and their own consequences, and I can have empathy and that's it, allows a kind of letting go of expectation that is...
A letting go of exaggerated responsibility, too.
That, too. But it has started to change my understanding of the relationship.
Yeah. I think it allows for more patience, too. It allows for more patience, you know. But it is, you know, and you know, restraint, you know, we don't let go, you know, but renunciation features pretty strongly in this teaching. But restraint is often said to be the forerunner, you know, and I think sometimes in situations, you know, especially of relationship, you know, restraint about some of our insistence and our knowing, our timetables, is actually very, very important. And it's kind of like a forerunner. It's one of the conditions of that allow renunciation to mature. So I wonder if we could... Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
I was wondering about the cultivation of these seven factors of awakening. They're clearly all interrelated, but I'm imagining there's different practices for each one.
Well, you know, it's not so much that there's different practices for each one, except perhaps concentration. Or also equanimity clearly has a sort of practice element to it. But the other qualities are really meant to be cultivated within all practices. They're meant to be the informing factors of all practices of meditation. You know, because if you look at any style of meditation, if they're absent, if they're missing in these qualities, it's pretty dry, you know, may not go anywhere because it doesn't have a sense of direction. Could just be quite mechanical. So in a way, these qualities cultivated within any style of practice almost is what the liberating energy of the practice is. It's the art part. And it's actually, I think, what allows any style of practice to actually have that liberating element.
It's kind of like the energy of the values themselves.
You know, say if you were, say, practicing the Brahma Viharas, where you could just be going there, through there, you know, repeating the phrases, you might want to look in that practice. Where is the energy, you know, where is the investigation? You know, Brahma Viharas, for most of us to develop kindness, involves some investigation of where there's no kindness. You know, what is being asked to be let go of, you know. So it's actually they're brought into the practice as a way actually of bringing, yeah, the practice to be a liberating practice.
And is there importance of mindfulness of being aware when these things are coming in?
And mindfulness is pretty much the foundation of any style of meditation. Yeah, the knowing. Okay, so perhaps we could end our day with just a very short sit and then come be on your way.